Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about the importance of nuts. Walnuts, almonds, pine nuts, pistachios, cashews, Brazilian nuts, filberts. They all have something in common, and it's all good. Also, ginger. Most people only know it as a unique, bittersweet seasoning, but it's far more than that. It's been used for a long time in cancer research, but we haven't been told about it. Now we will. How ginger has anti-metastatic properties that inhibit many types of cancer, including breast, colon, liver, lung, yes, prostate, pancreas, and melanomas. We're also going to learn about fiber restoring the microbiome diversity. What's that mean? Well, this is meaning that you can help prevent cancer, because this came from Cancer Weekly and done at the Major Immunological Research Center at the University of Alberta. I'll tell you how what you eat protects you against cancer that all begins in your gut. On also bridging the brain-body gap, how the thinking gut influences mental well-being. Once again, we're going to look at a different aspect of how the probiotics and prebiotics, for example, if you had beets, that's a prebiotic. If you had sauerkraut, that's a probiotic. If you had miso, that's a probiotic. What happens to your emotional well-being when you consume these? Some very good things happen, and we want you to know about that. Plus, rhubarb. No one eats rhubarb. I eat rhubarb because most people in the South, they have rhubarb. And it's delicious if it's prepared correctly, and it cuts the cancer cell growth by 50%. Who says? Emory University. And we'll tell you about that. Then today we're going to have a long interview continuing our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. We've had over 500 of these conversations. Today I think you'll find it really interesting. The unreliability of memory that has contributed to altered or invented stories in the New Testament, and who Jesus was. Who says? Professor Bart Ehrman. Who's he? Probably the world's most renowned biblical scholar. And he specializes in text of the New Testament in the origins of Christianity. Well, I have some questions for him. He is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Biblical and Christian Studies at University of North Carolina. And he knows all about the Gnostics, the historical origins, so I've got a lot of questions for this Princeton grad about the Bible, its contradictions, what's good, what's not good, what can we believe, what should we not believe, what is allegorical, what is historical, what is accurate. You're going to have a really interesting insight about, well, for instance, if I ask you, how long did it take to write the Bible, the Old Testament, New Testament? Do you know anyone who can answer that? I don't. But we'll see if he can. Also, we're going to hear from Alan Watts, clearly one of the most important philosophers in the 21st century. What's wrong with our culture? He gives us his insights. And then I follow that with George Carlin, The Illusions of Choice. As you see, we have a lot of variables. Let's begin. And the first thing we're going to talk about is something that we need to talk about, and that is the variety in our diet. Now, we know that fibers are good for us, but also oils are good. The more variety of fiber you have, like if, for example, the fibers from fruits, especially the berries, blueberries are your single best, softest, and most cleansing form of fiber. So the more blueberries you have, just on fiber alone, you're going to be healthier, because it will very gently create a very easy form of gel that is almost like pectin, and it sweeps out the debris from your intestines, and it happens to have some phytonutrients that also can heal those overinflamed cells in your intestines. So diverticulitis, spastic colon, Crohn's disease, all of those benefit from that. But then we also need not just fiber, we need the oils. And you don't get a lot of oils in fruits or vegetables, except for the avocado and the olive. But you do get oils from nuts. And those are some of your best oils. The oil from almonds and cashews, macadamias. In fact, macadamia nut oil is probably your most versatile oil, because when you use it, it keeps food from burning. Therefore, it keeps food from becoming a carcinogen. But it's also a healing oil. It's very good for your hair, your skin. There's new research now from the American Association for Cancer Research at their annual meeting, and they were looking at colon cancer and how to reduce it in men and women. And a Professor Shin, a preventive medicine at Seoul National University in College Medicine, said that eating three or more times a week just some nuts appears to have an enormous effect on preventing colon cancer. Now, my suggestion would be sprouted or raw nuts, not the toasted, roasted, deep-fried, and trans-fat nuts that you get commercially. And they presented all the evidence that it's the fats that are the healing, and those fats, once they're in your intestine, help prevent cancer. Another thing that can prevent cancer and nausea and upset stomach, ginger. Now, if you can grow ginger, you should. It is very easy to grow. And once it starts growing, it gives off a beautiful white flower. And it's a night bloomer. So its aromatic qualities come out at night, as does jasmine and lilac and lavender. But it's not the stem that can go 10, 15 foot. And you should cut it back so it regrows. But it's the root. And the longer the root in good, healthy soil, the more nutrients it has. And therefore, by fertilizing the soil once a month, you'll get an emulsion. And generally, you can get a seaweed emulsion, what's called a fish emulsion. And you spray it over there, about maybe a quarter of a cup per large plant area. You can grow 50 ginger in about 3 square feet. So that gives the soil richness. Remember, all plants need food. Whatever you planted them originally in, that's good for about a month. And a lot of people mean, you mean I have to fertilize a tree? 4 times a year you should put, depending upon the size and type of tree, anywhere from 5 to 10 pounds of fertilizer around the tree. That's how your tree is not deficient in manganese, which turns the leaves brown, but it's also true of fruit trees as well, and then you trim them, ideally to about an 8-foot level, and that way you get more concentrated fruit, richer in nutrients, because remember, the higher the tree, the less fruit, because the energy and nutrients are going in the growth of the tree, not in the fruit. So ginger, you harvest it, what do you do with it? Well, you wash it, you peel it, then you can dice it, and put it in a salad. You can juice it where you're going to get your most nutritional value. Or you can even dry it overnight in a food dryer that keeps it raw, because it keeps temperature around 110 degrees. So it evaporates the moisture, and then you can grind it into a powder and put it in a refrigerator, and it could stay for a year or two. Why should you want this ginger? It's simple. Ginger, not as just a great spice, a sweet spice, especially if you mix the ginger. You want to have a really interesting dish. Mix ginger with clove. The two together with tarragon will just pop the taste of any dish. But now there's research showing that it has anti-metastatic properties, which means that ginger, as a juice or as a powder, more powerful as a juice, can inhibit breast cancer, lung cancer, rectal cancer, liver, lung, prostate, pancreas, and melanoma. And that's what you want. So if you have cancer, taking in ginger 3 times a day, a teaspoon of the root, or let's say a half ounce. If I were doing it, helping you, I would tell you to take 1 ounce of ginger juice, 1 ounce of lemon juice, 1 ounce of curcumin juice, which is about 2,000 milligrams of curcumin, and dilute that in 16 to 20 ounces of green apple juice. Now, this is for all cancers. Doesn't matter what the cancer. Because this all has the capacity to cause what is known as cell suicide. It causes the cancer cell to kill itself, commit suicide, your cancer cells. And that's a good thing. And there was some good research done at the University of Minnesota, and they found that ginger can help prevent cancer as well. So now you got something that can prevent cancer, something that can help you if you have cancer. Also, a Dr. Rebecca Lai at the University of Michigan presented at the 97th Annual American Association of Cancer meeting that gingerols, that's G-I-N-G-E-R, gingerols, O-L-S, caused ovarian cancer cells to commit suicide. So for all the women, gingerols, now that's not ginger ale, but gingerols, are extremely important, and you can get that. And Georgia State University showed that ginger extract helped shrink prostate tumors by 55% in their laboratory experiments. So it's really anti-inflammatory, and cancer breeds in a highly inflammatory state. Now, from Cancer Weekly, when you have a wide variety of fibers in the diet, according to the study at University of Alberta, that can increase the health of the microorganisms and their diversity in your gut. So if you have fibers from grains, legumes, and seaweeds, and fruits, and tubers, the more variety of food you have in the diet, the more different variety of microorganisms you have, the healthier you're going to be. And also, this was confirmed at Stanford University as well. So get your wide variety of foods and get wide variety of fiber. And as I mentioned, a very good study was done that shows that, quote, the communication pathway occurring in a number of ways, gut bacteria produce feel-good brain chemicals as well as the existence of direct cell-to-cell communication. In addition, the lymphatic system could be considered another pathway from the gut to the brain. And what's this mean in lay language? It means that now we have to add a whole new science called gastroenterology, which means that whatever's occurring in our gut is also impacting our neurological system in our brain. So the healthy bacteria in your gut means a healthier communication with your brain. And this is known as the gut-brain axis. And this relationship forms the basis of the relatively new research field of the gastroenterology. So bad bacteria, sugar, donuts, bagels, you know, sandwiches, bad bacteria. Meat, alcohol, terrible bacteria. And then you end up with bad bacteria, bad messages to the brain. Hence, you can destroy a lot of neurons. In fact, the gut's alimentary canal contains over 100 million neurons, more than either the spinal cord or the peripheral nervous system. So when we say that your gut has a brain, it does. As its nervous system has a brain, and so your gut is communicating with your brain and your skull. So just eat right, and it makes a difference. And finally, from Emory University, we know that there is an orange pigment, It's found in many of the lichens and in the tart vegetables. And one of the tartest vegetables, rhubarb. And that's why in the South, what they do is they boil the rhubarb, and then they add in a ton of sugar to it, and then they add in a gelatin, and that's how they make their rhubarb jam. But if you want to do it correctly, yes, you could steam the rhubarb, or you could use a wok, in which case you put it in for about 5 minutes, and the steam loosens up this real stiff fiber. Then you can, if you want it sweet, you can take natural fruits like raspberries or oranges, and then you puree the rhubarb with that, and you can use that as a puree or as a parfait or as a pudding. Or you can take that rhubarb after you've loosened it up and sauté it with garlic. Lots of ways to use it. Most people have never tried it. But we have now found that what is called paritin, P-A-R-I-E-T-I-N, which is a phytochemical, can protect against cancer because it can prohibit the expression of an enzyme vital to cancer cell growth. That's good news. This was published in the journal Nature. So you want to be able to have rhubarb because it can cut the growth of lung cancer cells by a factor of 3 over the course of 11 days. So while it's lethal to cancer cells, paritin, in both dose amounts, left healthy cells alone. So that's good news. So let's use rhubarb, and it can starve cancer cells also. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today. By the way, a very rare interview tonight at 7 o'clock on the Progressive Commentary Hour, Conversations with Really Remarkable Minds, the unreliability, or excuse me, I'm going to have John Pilger on. John is the Australian journalist who has reported from around the globe about the atrocities of empire and the emergence of corporate militarism and genocides. And we'll be speaking with John about the emergence of the new rulers of the planet and looking back at how Western privilege and racism are contributing to horrendous acts of violence. And it's very rare to ever hear John in America on any media whatsoever. You'll hear him at 7 o'clock. Also, I've been asked about this new network I'm forming, and here's what I'm doing. I believe that there is room on the internet for voices of communities that are not being properly served today or served at all. For example, think of all the senior citizens who do not have seniors talking about the issues that empower them. That's important. You got 85 million seniors. Think of all the college students who end up with issues and questions, but they don't have voices to help them. That's a show. Questions on death and dying and afterlife or not. That's a show. On gardening and all the different aspects. There used to be a guy named Jerry Baker. He was the best gardening show in American history. He's not around anymore. At least I haven't heard him. That's a show. Talking about whole cultures, you know, like the Caribbean culture. But then in the Caribbean, you have uniquely different cultures in the Caribbean. You know, the cultures, traditions, the dishes, the way of life in Jamaica is not the same as in Trinidad, which is not the same as in Haiti. And so representing all the different cultures, cultures of South America, the Native American cultures, the African cultures, Asian cultures. So a cultural show that takes you around the world, giving you the insights to understand cultures that empower us. Every single show has to be based upon the premise, by the time I finish listening to this, will I be better empowered? And so we have dozens of issues that are not being handled. And so that's what this is going to be. If you feel you would like to apply for this as a host or producer, because we're starting in June, then you can call Jason, our program director, at 646-926-5422, and he'll talk with you, because we're going to launch, and it's going to be great. Let's go over now and take a look at Alan Watts' view of what's wrong with our culture.
Why is it that we don't seem to be able to adjust ourselves to the physical environment without destroying it? Why is it that in a way this culture represents in a unique fashion the law of diminishing returns, that our success is a failure, that we are building up, in other words, an enormous technological civilization which seems to promise the fulfillment of every wish almost at the touch of a button. And yet, as in so many fairy tales, when the wishes finally materialize, they're like fairy gold. They're not really material at all. In other words, so many of our products, our cars, our homes, our clothing, our food, it looks as if it were really the instant creation of pure thought. That is to say, it is thoroughly insubstantial, lacking in what the connoisseur of wine calls body. And in so many other ways, the riches that we produce are ephemeral. And as a result of that, we're frustrated. We're terribly frustrated. We feel that the only thing is to go on getting more and more. And as a result of that, the whole landscape begins to look like the nursery of a spoiled child who's got too many toys and is bored with them and throws them away as fast as he gets them, plays them for a few minutes. Also, we're dedicated to a tremendous war on the basic material dimensions of time and space. We want to obliterate their limitations. We want to get everything done as fast as possible. We want to convert the rhythms and the skills of work into cash, which indeed you can buy something with, but you can't eat it. And then rush home to get away from work and begin the real business of life, to enjoy ourselves. You know, for the vast majority of American families, what seems to be the real point of life, what you rush home to get to, is to watch an electronic reproduction of life. You can't touch it. It doesn't smell, and it has no taste. You might think that people getting home to the real point of life in a robust material culture would go home to a colossal banquet or an orgy of lovemaking or a riot of music and dancing. But nothing of the kind. It turns out to be this purely passive contemplation of a twittering screen. You see mile after mile of darkened houses with that little electronic screen flickering in the room. Everybody isolated, watching this thing, and thus in no real communion with each other at all. And this isolation of people into a private world of their own is really the creation of a mindless crowd. And so, we don't get with each other, except for public expressions of getting rid of our hostility, like football or prize fighting. And even in the spectacles one sees on this television, it's perfectly proper to exhibit people slugging and slaying each other, but oh dear no, not people loving each other, except in a rather restrained way. One can only draw the conclusion that the assumption underlying this is that expressions of physical love are far more dangerous than expressions of physical hatred. And it seems to me that a culture that has that sort of assumption is basically crazy and devoted, unintentionally indeed, but nevertheless in fact devoted, not to survival, but to the actual destruction of life.
Alan Watts. Now let's hear from George Carlin, who has something, you know, as he always does, probing to say about our freedoms, our quality of perception, and also the choices or the illusion of choices. And I think this is rather appropriate since right now people think they actually have some choices in this electronic era and this election campaign, and they don't.
We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car, can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the get out of your country, all right? Especially if your country is full of brown people. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country, tell them to watch it out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones. And that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. They schloop. That's our fish nickel. And you probably noticed, I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them, I don't really believe in my country, and I gotta tell you folks, I don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded.
I'm talking about the fact that a war is rich old men protecting their property by sending middle class and lower class young men off to die. Forget these foolish elections. The owners of this country don't care about the poor and young.
Karl Marx talking to me? The owners of this country are the voters of this country.
You're wrong about that, my friend.
Aren't the owners of this country the voters in this country?
No, they're not. Listen, politics, these elections are a charade. They are meant to... Well, I'll tell you, listen, just listen for a minute. Learn a little something. The elections and politicians are in place in order to give Americans the illusion that they have freedom of choice. You don't really have choice in this country. All of the things that are important reduced in choice. Newspapers in a city, how many? Used to be 3-4, now it's 1 or 2, they're owned by the same people, and they also own a radio station.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, I voted. The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized and made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff.
Okay. Not as a result of a conspiracy,
don't need a formal conspiracy.
Right.
When interests converge, these people went to the same universities and fraternities. They're on the same boards of directors. They're in the same country clubs. They have like interests. They don't need to call a meeting. They know what's good for them. They're getting it. And there used to be seven oil companies. There are now three. It will soon be two. The things that matter in this country have been reduced in choice. There are two political parties. There are a handful of insurance companies. There are about six or seven information things. But if you want a bagel, there are 23 flavors because you have the illusion. You have the illusion of choice.
Right.
You don't get the real importance. There's no freedom of choice.
That's a great point.
George Carlin on the illusion of choice. If we really had choice, we would have Jill Stein as a third-party candidate from the Green Party, but we don't have that. We would have had Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, but we didn't have them either. So for those of us who are not card-carrying Democrats or Republicans, who really want to find the truth that would be best for all Americans and our economy and the welfare of the planet, which candidate is that? The candidates that could represent that are not the candidates that can be corporately controlled. In a moment, my guest, please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world and all the stations carrying this program right now. Thank you. We're going to go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We're standing by as Professor Bart Ehrman, E-H-R-M-A-N. He is one of the most renowned biblical scholars in the world today, specializing in the texts of the New Testament and the origins of Christianity. He is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Biblical and Christian Studies, University of North Carolina, in Chapel Hill, where he specializes in the texts of the New Testament and Gnostic and historical origins of Christianity. He received his doctorate from Princeton University and received numerous awards for academic excellence. He is also the author or editor of over 30 books, five having appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. His most recent book is Jesus Before the Gospels, How the Earliest Christians Remembered, Changed, and Invented Their Stories of the Savior. His website is bartdehrman.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a historical gap of time between the death of Jesus, likely during the early years of the third decade A.D., and the appearance of the first literature and text telling us something about him, somewhere between 40 and 65 years. The assumption entertained by almost all Christians is that the memories of Jesus that we later find in the Gospels and other Christian texts were preserved, unchanged, through an oral tradition, and stories and quotes are assumed to have been passed down intact. This is critical because the New Testament and the books and letters that were selected as scripture a couple of years after Jesus' life in Palestine have served as the fundamental template for the development of Christianity over the centuries and how Christianity is practiced today. So please use this time as a forum to provide us with the most convincing evidence that you have based upon historical records and the insights from modern anthropology and sociology and psychology about the reliability of memory and recollection that should make us possibly pause and reconsider how valid the gospel's portrayal of Jesus really is. We might even consider how in the courts of law there are serious questions about the reliability of eyewitnesses in their testimony of events, which might be days, hours, or weeks at the most, and yet we're expected to believe that a person's memory is exact decades later. Is it possible? Could you enlighten us on this, please?
Well, I can try. Right. So that is absolutely the subject of my book. And in the book, I combine two interests of mine. One interest that I've had for about 40 years now, which is the historical Jesus. How do we know what Jesus really said and did? And the problems connected with that. And the problems are the ones that you pointed out, that Jesus probably died sometime around the year 30 of the Common Era. And the first account we have of his life is almost certainly the Gospel of Mark, which is probably written around the year 70 of the Common Era. The last Gospel of the New Testament is probably the Gospel of John, written maybe around the year 90 to 95. And that means that there's a large gap between 40 and 65 years between Jesus' death and the first surviving accounts of his life. And so for many, many years now, I've been interested in knowing, are the Gospels reliable accounts of what Jesus said and did, or do they contain exaggerations and distortions? And are there some stories in the Gospels that might have been actually invented by Christians rather than reflecting things that really happened? And so scholars, of course, have dealt with this problem for hundreds of years, and I've been interested in it for most of my adult life. About 3 or 4 years ago, I got interested in another topic, which I realized is completely relevant, which is memory studies. It turns out that scholars in other fields outside of New Testament, early Christianity, have long been interested in how well human memory works. How do we individually remember things? How do we remember things that we learn at school? Things that people teach us, and how do we remember events that happen to us, and how do we forget things, and how do we misremember things, and how do we invent memories? In addition to individual memories, scholars in the field of sociology have studied how social communities transform our personal memories so that our individual memories aren't simply a matter of cognitive psychology. They're also a matter of sociology, of our social groups affect our recollections of the past. And anthropologists who do work in ethnography, who go into different cultures and study them, have long studied oral cultures to see how oral societies pass along their traditions and whether they try to make sure that these traditions don't change or not. So these are all areas that I became interested in about 3 or 4 years ago, and I realized that this area of memory studies can help us understand how the early Christians were remembering Jesus. And so what my book is, Jesus Before the Gospels, it discusses what scholars of memory tell us about how we remember and how societies remember and how oral cultures pass on their traditions, and it discusses the ways in which this kind of research in other fields can help us understand about the reliability of the Gospels, whether the Gospels are telling us exactly what Jesus said and did, or whether the Gospels represent memories that, like all memories, are somewhat problematic. So the way that one goes about establishing that whether the Gospels represent accurate memories or not, there are a couple ways that one can do that. The first thing is what I've been alluding to, is what we know about memory. A lot of scholars over the years have argued that the Gospels are based on eyewitness testimony, either that the Gospel writers themselves were eyewitnesses, or that they are basing their accounts on what they heard from eyewitnesses. And the tacit assumption behind that is that if there are eyewitness accounts behind the Gospels, then they must be reliable. Well, one area of interesting research in modern scholarship outside of New Testament studies is the study of eyewitness testimony. This has been studied, of course, by psychologists, but also by legal scholars who are interested in knowing, if you have an eyewitness to a crime, can you trust what the eyewitness says? And the consistent finding in study after study after study, is that is probably what you would expect, that eyewitnesses are not necessarily reliable, that eyewitnesses get a lot of things wrong, and simply on the basis of eyewitness testimony, you can't trust that you know what actually happened. And so the tacit assumption that if the Gospels are based on eyewitnesses, therefore they're reliable, seems to be false. But there's a further study, a further question of whether the Gospels actually are based on eyewitnesses. And this is where the history of early Christianity comes into play, because it appears on the basis of long research done by biblical scholars that, in fact, the Gospels are not actually based on eyewitness testimony at all. The eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus would have been Aramaic-speaking lower-class peasants from rural Galilee. Those are the people that Jesus spent his time with during his public ministry. These would have been illiterate people. The vast majority of people in Palestine in Jesus' day were illiterate. They simply never gone to school. They didn't learn how to read and write. And so the followers of Jesus almost certainly could not write at all. The Gospels, on the other hand, are not written by lower-class Aramaic-speaking peasants. The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all written in Greek by people who are highly educated, highly literate, who are living in some country other than the one Jesus was in. They're not from Palestine, and their language isn't the same as Jesus. And so these Gospel writers certainly are not some of the people who were following Jesus. And the stories that they're writing are stories that had been in circulation in Greek. In other words, these are stories that may have started out in Palestine, some of them, or many of them, but they come to the Gospel writers in a different language, living in a different country, living decades later. And so that opens up the question about how reliable these things can be.
I appreciate that insight. I have a few questions, though.
Yes, I'm happy,
For quite a few decades now, there's been agreement among biblical scholars that there was an unknown written text that at least two of the Gospels, Luke and Matthew, relied upon. Scholars have named this text Q, or the Q source. Very few people know about this other source that has been lost and may likely serve as a fifth gospel if it were preserved. Please tell us about the text and why it's important for our understanding on the development and composition of the Gospels.
Yes, it's a great question. So the idea of the existence of this Q source arose in the 19th century in Germany, when scholars were trying to understand why Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those three Gospels in particular, have so many stories in common. They tell many of the same stories. Usually the stories are sequenced in the same sequence, so this happened, then this happened, then that happened. And often the stories are told in precisely the same words. And it was reasonably assumed that you can't have stories told in the same words unless somebody's copying somebody. And so it came to be thought that Mark was the first gospel to be written, that Matthew and Luke both used Mark for their accounts. And so that's fairly widely accepted. In fact, it's the consensus view among scholars today is that Mark was the first gospel. Matthew and Luke both used it. Matthew and Luke also have a number of traditions, though, that are not found in Mark. These are mainly sayings. And so, for example, the Lord's Prayer is in Matthew and Luke, but it's not in Mark. The Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, you'll find the Beatitudes in Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. So the question is, where did Matthew and Luke get those sayings from, since they couldn't have gotten them from Mark? And it came to be thought, for pretty good reasons, that Matthew probably did not copy Luke at that point, and that Luke did not copy Matthew, and so they must have gotten this material from someplace else. And the scholars who devised this called this other hypothetical source that Matthew and Luke both used for material not found in Mark, they called this the saying source. In German, the word for source is Quelle, spelled with a Q, Q-U-E-L-L-E. And so this source then came to be known as Q. the hypothetical source that appears to have lay behind both Matthew and Luke for many of their sayings that are not found in Mark. So we wish we had this Q source. Unfortunately, we don't have it. All we have are we have ways of reconstructing it based on studying Matthew and Luke. But we think that it did at one time exist. We don't know when it was written. It appears to have been written in Greek. And so it's usually dated maybe in the 50s or the 60s of the Common Era, possibly sometime before Mark, or possibly right around the time of Mark.
Okay, the biblical texts are regarded by Christians as having been divinely inspired by their authors. Therefore, it's assumed that the information conveyed is infallible. And certainly literalists, and there are a lot of fundamentalist Christians, hold this view of literalism. Yet anyone who takes the time to critically and objectively read and compare the New Testament text will immediately find contradictions. For example, did Jesus die on the cross or on a tree, as we find in the book of Acts? Did Peter first discover Jesus' tomb empty, or did the women companions of Jesus in one of the other Gospels, did Judas commit suicide or have an accident and died in a field? So we find these contradictions in different stories right in the New Testament itself. We don't have to look very far to find inconsistencies. Could you give us an example or two of inherent contradictions found in scriptural stories that you believe are most important because they have a more profound impact on the creation of the underlying theology that gave rise to the religion we now call Christianity?
Right. So in some ways, this is what my book is about. It's about how you have these different stories that cannot be reconciled with each other, which show the fact that you have these kinds of discrepancies almost certainly shows that people are changing the stories based on either how they're remembering the stories themselves or just changes in the stories in the process of transmission. And so there are a lot. I mean, you've mentioned some really interesting discrepancies. There's some discrepancies that it's possible, if you work hard enough, you can reconcile. There are other discrepancies that look like it's almost impossible to reconcile. I'll just give you one example about, you're asking about a key understanding with early Christianity. There's nothing more important, of course, than the Christian belief that Jesus was raised from the dead. It is interesting, though, that when you compare the accounts of Jesus' resurrection in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there are large numbers of discrepancies. My students sometimes have trouble believing me when I tell them that, and so I actually don't list the discrepancies for them. I tell my students, read through Matthew's account and list everything that happens, then Mark's, then Luke's, then John's. Make a list of everything that happens in all four in order, and then compare the lists. And my students find all sorts of differences that they had no way of expecting, but they're there. I'll just give you one. In Matthew's gospel, when the women go to the tomb, they meet an angel there, and the angel tells them to go tell the disciples that Jesus is going to go before them and meet them in Galilee. They're supposed to go to Galilee from Jerusalem. So we're talking about an 80-mile trip by foot. And so the disciples go up to Galilee, and they see Jesus there, and Jesus gives them his final instructions, and then the gospel ends. So in that gospel, Jesus doesn't meet with them in Jerusalem. He meets with them in Galilee after they go there. In Luke's gospel, what we're told is that on the day of his resurrection, Jesus appeared to the disciples in Jerusalem, and he tells them, don't leave the city of Jerusalem. Stay in the city. And then he gives them his final instructions, and he ascends to heaven. And then in the book of Acts, written also by the same author, by the author of Luke, the disciples do stay in the city. They're there for 40 days up until the day of Pentecost when the Holy Spirit comes upon them, and then they still stay in the city. In other words, they're in the city the entire time, up until Jesus leaves them and then after Jesus leaves them. Whereas in Matthew, they didn't stay in the city at all. They went directly to Galilee. So It's very hard to reconcile these two. I'd say it's impossible to reconcile these two. And it raises the question, I mean, do we know what happened when the women went to the tomb or not? This is a fundamental question in early Christianity, and the Gospels appear to be at odds about it.
While I find history intriguing and always have been fascinated by it, unless history is brought into the context of our own time, it can lose much of its significance for many listeners. Christianity remains the largest religion in the world if we include all of its many sects, and it has in the past and continues today to be an influential force in the shaping of our government and policies, even at the local community levels. It also continues to inspire numerous people, either for good or bad. Yet from all the wonderful research you have conducted and your conclusions, we are faced with a dilemma of tantamount proportions. That is, the New Testament, many of the beliefs held in common by most Christians, may all be based upon fabrications or errors. And if this is in any way the case, then can we accurately conclude that there even exists a Christianity in the world today as Jesus may have wanted it? Are we not faced then with the possibility that modern Christianity is largely a fabrication and creation of the imaginations of people who imagine themselves as carriers of Jesus' original message, but only in their imaginations and false memories? And I'll add one additional construct to that. Why is it that in the history of the Bible, you don't see the women authors or women being given the same privilege of insight and capacities for healing and divine inspiration as you do men? And why were women excluded? And if women were excluded for anything that today we would consider misogynist or paternalistic objectification, what does that tell us about the underlying ethics and morality of those authors? And then finally, you have the Gospels, which we rely upon, and any organization that is built upon certain shared values and principles that unite its members together, and these were being formed in many areas around the Mediterranean and the Middle East shortly after Jesus' death. Some were primarily Jewish, others were Gentile or formerly pagan. They spoke different languages, such as Aramaic or Latin or Coptic or Greek. And so how important is the culture of the community in the shaping of the stories and teachings surrounding Jesus and its immediate followers as examples of how accurate could these Gospels be? For example, the Gospel of Thomas, which is not included in the New Testament. Most of the other non-canonical texts were under the umbrella term Gnosticism, such as those uncovered in the Nag Hammadi Library in the Egyptian desert, were likely written much later, even a couple hundred years later. In light of that, then how could we possibly believe that anything they contained was anything other than simple fabrications? Or could there have been kernels of truth in those texts as well? So it leaves many people with a question about the legitimacy of the foundational beliefs of a religion, the largest in the world, that has a lot of contradictions. And then what should we do? Take the best that we can glean from this as inspirations for living a higher moral life? Or should we act more like those who believe in the pure word as literalists, in which case you get yourself into a lot of contradictory positions? Final thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, okay. You're right. That's a lot of questions, and they're all rooted in a very similar question that I think is, you know, ultimately the most important one. As I can sense you also agree. I mean, you know, is the Christianity represented in the life of Jesus, is it fundamentally the same as what people have today or not? And if what people have today is not what Jesus represented, then is what people have today a fabrication? I would say that the religion of Jesus, the religion that Jesus himself had, is not related very closely to any forms of Christianity we have today. That's because Christianity, as it developed historically, became the religion that was focused on Jesus' death and resurrection and how the death and resurrection of Jesus can make a person right with God. That's not what Jesus himself was about. Jesus himself was Jewish. Jesus was proclaiming an understanding of Judaism that he took to be true Judaism, but he wasn't advocating the beginning of a new religion. So Christianity from its very beginning was different. It was the religion about Jesus rather than the religion that Jesus himself held. I myself am not a Christian, and so even though this is my field of scholarship, and even though I was raised Christian and started out in this field very gung-ho Christian, I'm not a Christian now, and so there's that to be said. But on the other hand, I don't think that it's quite right to say that all of Christianity therefore is a fabrication and should be rejected. My view is that if somebody wants to be a follower of Jesus today, they have to translate the teachings of Jesus into our modern idiom. We can't pretend that we're living in the first century Palestine when we're living in 21st century America. We have a whole different set of assumptions about the world, a whole different set of ideologies, a whole different set of worldviews. But the teachings of Jesus could still be relevant to this setting. But you have to translate them. You can't simply assume that Jesus' own teachings or the teachings of Paul or any of the early Christians necessarily can be transposed into our own situation. You have to understand what's relevant about those teachings for the modern world. And I appreciate Christians who do that, even though I myself am not a Christian.
I appreciate that also. And remember, when we talk about the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke, there is no proof that Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John were actually real people.
That's a major point in my book, yes, is that we don't know who actually wrote these books.
And we don't know what their political motivations were, their social motivations, their humanistic motivations or not. And that's why the best that it can be is to take that which inspires you at a deeper, more passionate, moral, and ethical level, to live as Jesus would have lived, and to have shared as Jesus would have shared, to have forgiven as he would have forgiven, and to feel blessed that you are part of a larger world community where people are not excluded because of their race, ethnicity, religion, or anything else, which is what I believe that Jesus is either a real figure, a historical figure, a metaphorical figure would have represented, and each of us has to determine that for our own. Thank you very much, Professor Bart Ehrman, for coming on and sharing your insights. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Professor Bart Ehrman, arguably one of the greatest minds on biblical scholars in the world today, and he is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Biblical and Christian Studies, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And his new book is Jesus Before the Gospels. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.